Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table, where we discuss issues about the connection between God and culture. And our topic today is cultural engagement and culture making. And our guest via Skype is Andy Crouch, author of Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling. And Andy hosted an all-day seminar here at the seminary a while back, and we have wanted to follow up with him because he did such a great job. So, Andy, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much. So glad to be here. Wish I could be there in person. It was great when I was there.
Well, we really enjoyed having you. And then to my right here is Andy Seidel, who's the executive director of the Howard G. Hendricks Center for Christian Leadership. And we're adding on in cultural engagement.
There we go.
And so, and I am Daryl Bach, executive director of the Center for the Cultural Engagement aspect. So you've got the full team here as we discuss culture together. Andy, I'm just going to dive right in. Let's talk first about a word that I think at the seminar you said is one of the most difficult words to define in the English language. With an introduction like that, I'm going to give you 30 words or less. define culture. Yeah, what is culture and how should we think about it?
So I borrow a wonderful definition from culture from the journalist Ken Myers, and he sums up what I think a lot of sociologists and anthropologists take many more words to say. Ken defines culture as what human beings make of the world in both senses. So that's quite a bit under 30 words, so let me say just a couple more words about that. Culture is what we make of the world, and by that I think Ken intends us to pay attention, first of all, to the material aspect of culture. It's actually the physical production of human activity. It's not just ideas, it's not just values, it's not just art or the works of imagination. It's actually embodied, you might say, in very concrete things that people make. And then it's also, although it is material, it's also the other sense of that phrase, what you make of the world, which is it's the human attempt to find meaning in the world and to discover, if we can, what does this world signify? What's the significance of life in this world that seems mysterious, beautiful, wonderful, terrible, but doesn't come with any explanation sort of written out or any obvious explanation, just naturally. So it's that combination of meaning making and material making that adds up to culture.
And so when we talk about meaning making in particular, we're talking about the fact that we as human beings invest the things around us and the combination of the way things interact around us with meaning. And
yes.
And the flip side of this is that although we make meaning for culture, culture also in very many ways shapes us as well, because we aren't born in a vacuum. We walk into this meaning making that's going on around us. Is that correct?
We come in thousands and thousands of years into the story of human beings making something of the world, and thank goodness we don't have to sort of start from scratch, because we'd have to discover fire, invent the wheel, invent language. No, you're absolutely right. And this is a very important aspect of culture, is it's kind of reflexive and iterative nature. It's iterative. This process happens over and over again, in one sense with every generation, but in another way, it's reflexive in that we make it, but then it turns around and acts on us, most of all in human development. You arrive as a little baby, and the first thing you start to try to do is make sense of the world that you're in, and that world is just as much cultural as natural. And so you start trying to figure out what all this means, including language and symbolism and music and stories, as well as concrete artifacts. So culture acts on us, and in fact, I'm sure we're going to talk later about, should Christians be transforming culture, withdrawing from culture?
That's where we're going.
That's where we're going.
Yeah.
It's very important to remind ourselves that culture acts on us and transforms and shapes us much more than we ever shape it. I'm much more shaped by culture than I could in my wildest dreams hope to affect or shape culture. And that's the reflexive power of culture.
Well, I'm going to work our way there. And the way I want to work our way there is to talk about the fact that really, in many ways, we aren't just talking about culture as a single monolith, but culture itself is made up of many, if I can say, little cultures that are within it that also interact with each other. And I think the best way to illustrate this, and I'm going to bring in Andy here in a second on this, but when my wife and I moved to Germany for sabbatical, all the rules for marital interaction and what you could do in the society changed.
Wow.
Things that she could normally do here and have happen effectively, she was cut off from doing in part because she didn't know the language. So that was a little bit of a disadvantage.
Yes.
And then secondly, the culture responded to a woman doing certain things in a certain way that made it less comfortable for her to initiate that process. And so I had to step in. And our line was, we moved and all the rules changed. Andy, I know, has had a lot of experience in Eastern Europe. I'm sure you found the same thing. Is that true?
Oh, very much so. We lived really outside of Vienna in Austria. And they had very different rules than we did here. For example, my wife used to walk every morning, and she'd walk the same path, and she would see these two women. And it took, really, she said, about 3 or 4 years before they would smile, and then it was another year before they would talk to her.
Okay, now I don't even want to know what kind of culture making that is, but anyway. but that's the point. The point is that what we view as culture here in, say, Dallas, which is where we are, or where you're looking, where are you sitting these days?
Yeah, I'm sitting in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia.
Okay, so you're outside of Philly. We won't get into the Dallas, Philly thing in the NFL.
Yeah, that's right.
Even within the United States, those are different mini cultures. And then you turn around and you change countries and the rules change yet again. Shows how complex culture is, correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think you can make a pretty strong case that the idea of culture as a kind of abstract noun really emerged from encounters with different cultures. The sort of a cliche, but it's a useful cliche. As long as you are a fish swimming in one little pool, you don't think of yourself as being in the water, you know? And people talk about culture that way. It's very much in the background until you leave your home environment. And you go to some place where it's fellow human beings. They're Homo sapiens, image bearers, just like us, but they've made something very different of the world, sometimes shockingly different, disturbingly different. And the attempt to sort of give a name to all those different patterns of making is what we mean when we use the word culture in the abstract. But culture never exists in the abstract. It's always the product of a specific history of people trying to make something of the world. And it's affected by geography. It's affected by history, just by the happenstance of history. So that just the story of what happened in Austria or Germany is different from what happened in Texas. And that has generated, I think you used a very interesting word, which is rules. One of the things cultures do is tell us how the world, not just how it is, but how it ought to be. And they impose sanctions, both in the sense of positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement, when you either make the world the way it ought to be or violate the world the way the world ought to be. And this gets to a very important point about all cultures. They're not just sort of neutral background. They really do tell us what you are allowed to do. Are you allowed to talk to a stranger? How are you allowed to talk to a stranger? What are you allowed to say to a stranger? They tell us what you can do, what you cannot do, and they really constrain human action as well as make human action possible. This is one of the things I like to emphasize, because when we think culture is just about music or art or even ideas or values, we can leave the impression it's kind of optional. I mean, you know, if you don't have to go to an art museum if you don't want to, but you are bound to and bound by culture, and it is shaping your assumptions about what it is to be human every single moment of the day.
If you're a fish, that water is all around you, whether you want it to be or not.
That's right. And you need it as much as the fish needs it.
Yeah.
if we could somehow take you out of culture, you'd be gasping. You wouldn't know who you were. You would actually be not less free than you are, even though culture also constrains your freedom. It's a very interesting kind of paradox there.
Yeah, well, I don't want to turn this into a seminary class on the abstract idea of culture, so I want to shift our attention a little bit. One of the other things you emphasize that I think people don't normally think about when they think of culture is this idea that culture isn't just ideas or values. It's also the things that we produce that shape the way we live. And in the book, you use the example of what happened when the interstate highway system came to the United States, and just the change that meant, that generated all kinds of industry, or it promoted some existing industries. It put pressure on other things that did exist, that had existed, and made them in some ways perhaps less valuable or changed where they fit. There was all this kind of cause and effect. I think in our own lifetime here lately, the thing that shows this more than anything else may be the little thing called the iPod, which when it showed up generated it made all kinds of things possible. It also relativized, if I can use that word, a whole lot of other things that existed. So that's another dimension of culture we often don't think about that is culture making as well, isn't it?
Yeah, this is really why I ended up titling the book I wrote about this, Culture Making. Because it really is when we make things, you know, the technical term for these, I suppose, is artifacts. You can also think of them, the phrase I like is cultural goods. Cultural goods are the medium by which even the most intangible parts of culture are expressed and made manifest and in a way kind of enforced. And when you make a new cultural good, it can be, it's almost always both something very specific like an iPod. And usually there's a whole system behind that. So you think about iTunes, the software behind the iPod. These very concrete goods, along with the systems that kind of support them. You can think about cars and interstates in the same way. It starts to move the horizons of possibility for human beings. That is to say, some things become possible that were not possible before. There was no way for me to carry around my music collection with me wherever I went before the iPod and its immediate predecessors, MP3 players. Suddenly, I can do that. Well, that then has all these knock-on effects, which are fascinating and important to understand because they really do reshape the way they live, the way that we live. But at the same time, that some things are becoming impossible. Some things are becoming possible. Other things are becoming impossible. That is to say, the introduction of cultural goods doesn't just expand the horizons so that more and more things become possible. It moves the horizons so that some things that were completely possible before are now all but impossible now. For example, making money as a record company was very possible in the
with
second
45
half
with 45 RPM.
Certain artifacts become, you know, just they become artifacts in the archaeological sense, relics of another time. They had tons of meaning, you know, for a person of a certain age. The 45 RPM has all this significance, but to my 16-year-old son, it means nothing, right? It doesn't impinge on his life in any way. And that's how culture works. It's constantly moving these horizons. And the important corollary of this is if we want to see culture change, it's not enough to change ideas. And it's definitely not enough just to change hearts or attitudes. We've got to actually give people a way to act on those new ideas. And frankly, if you can provide a compelling enough cultural good, the ideas and shape of life will follow that good rather than you having to convince them of the idea first. Sometimes the goods come before the idea. So the invention of keeping time, clocks, first water clocks, then tower clocks in Europe, and then eventually watches. Those things were invented and then reshaped the way people thought about time, rather than people saying, you know, we need to be more timely, so let's invent a watch. It didn't work that way. It went the other way around.
Well, and of course, sometimes when you invent something, there's, and this will be the last abstract question we deal with, but sometimes when you invent something, there's what you intend to do with it, and then there are the consequences that come out of it that you didn't even have in mind, but that someone else who culture makes does with it, and it goes off in a direction, and it can go in any kind of direction, intended or not, which shows how dynamic culture is and how difficult it is to, if the word is difficult, my goodness, the whole phenomenon of culture is difficult because it's like an untamed tiger in some ways.
Absolutely. No one has the capacity to predict what any significant cultural innovation will do. It's too public. Too many people act on it. Too many people respond in unpredictable ways. You know, one of the most remarkable results of the interstate highway system, well, the most remarkable result was suburbia. 50% of Americans, more than 50%, now live in suburbs. And that really, suburbs the way we know them now did not exist before the interstate highway system. But I think you might have been able to foresee that to some extent. But who would have foreseen the rise of fast food? And fast food is also an artifact of the highway system. You would not have these dominant fast food chains if we hadn't had interstate highways. I guarantee you that when Dwight Eisenhower signed the National Interstate Highway and Defense Act, he was not thinking about McDonald's being, you know, one of the largest companies in the world. But that's a result, and you never can foresee those kinds of effects.
Now, all of this means, I'm going to turn in a practical direction now, all this means that we need to be, if I can use this word, a little bit humble about how we think about culture, interact with culture, our expectations about culture changing. There's a lot of Christian language today about culture changing. You've highlighted the issue of culture making in contrast. I want you to explain why that is and why that difference is so important to appreciate. And I think we've set the context for that by what we've said.
Yeah, I know, you know, this first section has been kind of abstract, but it's important. It's foundational because it chastens our pride or hubris, our overreaching. And I started to feel, part of why I wanted to call this book and this sort of line of thought, culture making, is I started to hear these just crazy verbs being thrown around. Like, we're here to impact the culture. Now, the first problem with that is not a verb. I'm going to hold the line. I refuse to let impact become a verb. But, I mean, that's a very strong word. You know, impact. You know, my fist impacts your, you know, cheek or whatever. The chance of any person or any group of people doing anything remotely like impact when you're talking about something as complex, as multifaceted, as responsive, as cumulative as culture is very small. Even the verb, it's a softer verb, but transforming culture, which Richard Niebuhr used in his book, Christ and Culture, his kind of punchline is, rather than being against culture or being simply seeing Christ as being of culture, we should talk about Christ transforming culture. When you turn that into Christians transforming culture, let's leave aside what Christ may be doing, but what are we doing? I think it's way overreaching to think that we can transform culture. That is above our pay grade by many steps. And the problem is, if you set yourself up to try to have a transformative impact, you are likely to mortgage yourself to whatever you think can get you there. And you will end up being, you'll end up being implicated in all kinds of foolishness that you shouldn't have been. And a very classic example of this is the way that the religious right, in its quest to transform American politics, at least for a season, became very captive to other interests within the Republican Party. And they were much more transformed by entering the Republican Party than the Republican Party was transformed by them. And that tends to happen when you overreach in this way.
Join us next week for part two of the Table Podcast. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.